Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bigfoot Notes from the Field. I'm your host, William Jevning. Today we're going to have a roundtable discussion with Dustin Clark and Jeremiah Fountain. Our long-lost Jeremiah is back with us again after some surgery and all the things that TW said probably weren't true, but I'm going to leave that between the two of them. Fellas, how are you doing tonight?
Good, Will. How you doing? How you doing, Dustin? It's good to be back. Missed you guys. Feeling good. Ready? Missed talking Bigfoot with all my brothers of the squat, you know?
I did want to make one announcement, too. Two announcements. First of all, for anybody who's listening who hasn't checked out the website, go to my website, williamjevning.com, and there's lots of cool things to look at there. If you want to join the JRG, the Jevning Research Group, if you scroll down the main page, you're going to see some items at the top of the page. One of those is research teams. Place your cursor over that and you'll get a drop down menu, and you can we don't have pages for all the teams that are part of the JRG, but you can get a hold of the regional directors. There's emails and phone numbers, and pretty much you can get a hold of anybody on any one of the pages that are up there, and they will direct you to the right people who are close to you or closest to you. And if you're interested, you know, in joining a team that already exists or creating your own, we'll set you up. Also, under shop, I have an online store. You can go there, and there's a lot of really cool artwork, especially from people like our good friend Shane Church. And you can place that artwork on pretty much anything: shirts, hoodies, cups, you name it, it's on there. It's all one flat price. So, with the holidays coming up, check that out. At the end of this show, because of Thanksgiving, I'm going to attach the interview that I did with Dustin. Nice. So, folks, you're going to get a bonus with this show this week. So, when we're done with this one, stay tuned, because I'm going to attach that. It's about 38 minutes long to this hour, so stay tuned for that. Fellas, Jeremiah in particular, you had sent us a report, and we'll start off. We're going to do a roundtable discussion, so we never quite know the direction of these discussions, so we're going to start off talking about that report, and we'll just go from there. So Jeremiah, sure. The floor is yours. Do you want to tell us about this gentleman that you interviewed?
Absolutely. I got to be really discreet about this report. About what we're going to discuss in this report. Originally, the guy's from my area, from the Adirondack area of upstate New York. I didn't know him well. I kind of was connected to him from another individual, an individual that I know well, we'll call him sort of a middleman. he is a retired Air Force security police officer. He was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. That's about, I can say that much at least. In the mid-90s, on a particular evening, they had to head out to go to another site, which he referred to as Alpha Site, with two, what he called specialists or technicians, if you will. Now, Will, you're going to have to kind of help me here how far we can go in the air with this, about the particular kind of site they were going to.
If it's something that's, too off track, I can always edit. So, go right ahead.
We'll call it a silo for now. Is that...
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ex-Army, so I'm not really that familiar with Air Force stuff, but so this was a missile.
Site. That's correct. Okay. So he and another security police officer had to go to a missile silo with two technicians. They had to repair something. He didn't get into that. He said it was a pretty clear night. The silo was going to take, it was a couple hours, and it's out in the wilderness, as the three of us know, Montana is in the lower 48 states. As the areas in Montana, that's as pretty remote as it can get.
People are kind of few and far between there.
That's pretty wild territory. So they head out, and you know, as they get there, they get to the main gate. They turn on their they're in a Humvee. They turn on the floodlights or the off road lights, whatever you want to call them. Now, once they get into the main gate, and everything, you know, is illuminated. Okay, now standing there, they take a look. There's this creature. And he referred to it. Now, he was not familiar with this subject at all, growing up. He said, you know, he saw the Patterson film maybe one time, you know, kind of brushed it off. You know, not like us where we were into it when we were younger, you know. So he referred to this thing as a Yeti. So that kind of gives you an idea of how unfamiliar with this topic he was.
Let me ask you one thing. How long ago did this happen?
He did not give me an exact date. He said it was in the mid-90s.
Okay.
You know, so it was some time ago. You know, like I said, he's retired now.
Sure.
So as soon as they got a look at this thing, it took off. And he said this thing was amazing. You know, when it took off, and there was a... He said, you know, the barbed wire fence, and the fence itself, he said, was about 6 feet, okay? And the razor wire on top would probably, you know, Will, you were military, that would probably give it another foot at least, the razor wire.
Yeah, a couple of feet.
Well, you know, he said this thing was probably 40, you know, 50 feet away, maybe. He said that thing took two or three bounds, and it jumped this thing. It leaped. It leaped over this fence. You know, that's amazing. You know, that's just unreal.
That is being familiar with those military fences, yeah.
You know, he said this thing, and he said it looked like it went over this thing with ease. You know, now, as far as, well, first of all, he said when this thing went over it, it just took off. You know, it went right back into the wilderness, and it was gone. Now, he said, he told me, when I asked him what kind of a look he got at this thing, you know, he said to me, you know, surprisingly, he said, you know, how fast it moved. He did kind of get a glimpse at it. He was very specific about the hair, how it was not universal. Different lengths around the body.
Right. And we hear that a lot.
Right. As a matter of fact, he said the hair was very long around the hip region. Very long. Just not universal. And he mentioned a mane around the head area.
Okay.
He didn't get a look at the face. You know, he described a classic Sasquatch. You know, he said the hair, dark brown to black hair. And he said around the feet, you know, when this thing took off, he noticed the feet and the hair, he said, almost came over the feet. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
You know, draped over the feet. You know, he said this thing was massive. He said, but what really caught his attention was the muscle density in the hip and the buttocks area. You know, he said that, yes, the chest, the shoulders, the arms were amazing. But the hips and the legs, he said, just really caught his attention. He said, just an unreal beast of a creature. The way it leaped that fence was just amazing. Now, he mentioned that, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, Will, that when they get to these sites, now the security police officers were supposed to get out and do a perimeter check, you know, and secure the perimeter. Safety reasons, make sure no one was there or whatever. Now, all four of them saw this thing, okay? And they looked at each other, and pardon my French, but he said to F you, you know, to protocol. None of them would get out of the vehicle.
Yeah, in other words, they didn't want to get out and do
this. They did not want to get out. You know, they...
I can't blame them.
Yeah, they were armed with M16A2 assault rifles, and they each had, you know, 9mm Berettas, okay? And they refused to get out of the vehicle because they were afraid if this thing were to come back that they didn't have enough firepower to put it down.
Well, and I can tell you, one, from having been in the military, and second, having seen Sasquatches, you know, an M16 round is not really that big a round. It's the bullet itself is a little more, you know, for lack of a better descriptive term, a little more than a 22 round, elongated. That's
right. 223,
with 223 with a big casing behind it.
Absolutely.
But when you're going to shoot an animal that size, it's very little comfort. I mean, unless you got a bunch of magazines to go through.
Well, the
same thing with a 9mm. It's just not a big enough round.
Yeah, 9mm. You may as well just throw that on the ground. Right.
I mean, you would do it. You would use it in self-defense, obviously.
Obviously. You know, like you seeing these creatures, you know, I can see where he's coming from. I mean, and the thing is, you know, when you start shooting in this thing, you know, as it's coming near you, and another thing that would go going through your head, am I going to have enough time to empty enough rounds into this thing to begin with before it gets me? You know, knowing how fast they move, and, you know. So, you know, they set the hell of protocol, you know. So they pulled in, quickly let the technicians do what they had to do, and he said they got the hell out of there. He said the only evidence this thing was there was the track line it made to the fence as it jumped over. What was really weird, he says, is there was nothing, no sign of where it came in or anything. He said they did have some snow earlier in the day. But the question being is how long that thing was there and what the hell was it doing there?
You know? I mean, and unless you really take the time to search an area to see where, you know, the creature came into the area and then obviously checking where it left, you know, in a situation like that, they didn't really know much about the creatures.
No.
They happened upon it. They had the underwear changing moment.
That's right.
And I'm sure just wanted to get out of the area, so they weren't really looking.
Absolutely not, he said. You know, and they couldn't figure out where it came from. They all had a long discussion before they went back to base. None of them said a word because they were worried about losing their security clearance. They were worried.
So obviously they didn't want to file a report.
Absolutely not. And I was the third person he told about this incident. Other than his wife and this other guy that introduced me to him. It was disturbing, he said, to talk about. Held it in for years. He just said it was just a very humbling moment. You know?
What do you think, Dustin?
Did by chance, I know he said that it jumped the fence and everything, but did he estimate of how tall it was?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to get to next. He said, you know, it was hard to, you know, judge. If it had been standing right up to the fence, it would have been easier. But a guesstimate, he said this thing stood probably 7.5-8 feet tall. You know, probably more towards 8 feet.
You know, I'll tell you what. Now, we were talking about, you know, in the beginning, with the roundtable discussion, and before we came on the air, we were talking about a number of different things. One of the things that just came to mind, of course, and a lot of people ask about, or what sort of capabilities would a Sasquatch have physically, and obviously not things like, you know, teleporting from one dimension to another or nonsense like that, but being able to clear a fence like that. And I can tell you there, and this one sort of makes me shake my head, there are people with doctorate degrees involved in the subject, and I won't name names, who claim that to believe that a Sasquatch can't run. And yet time and again we hear these accounts from very credible witnesses like this gentleman. They were all active duty military in a high security area, which means they had to go through a rigorous process to get the clearances to work in those areas. They see this creature not just there, but it clears, it runs and jumps over this fence.
Yep.
You know, and so in the first place, there aren't too many animals that can't run.
Right.
That have legs and live on land, mammals, especially primate species.
Right.
Primates, when you look at other primates, and that's something we were talking about on last week's show. You know, for those who may not have heard that episode, I was talking with two friends who are scientists,
yep.
one of them being an anthropologist, yes. and we were talking about, and in fact, I've got to get those guys back on because we barely scratched the surface on the subject of Bigfoot. But, you know, when you use comparative anthropology when looking at these creatures, and you take a look at what chimps and gorillas and other primates do, and try to say, well, we heard that this creature was reported doing A, B, and C. And then we take a look at the other primates and see, well, do they also do A, B, and C, or variations of those things? And oftentimes we find that they
do. Absolutely.
So it's not a stretch, especially something as large as they are, and very physically well adapted to their surroundings to be able to do something like that.
Well, I can tell you they run because I've seen them run. You know,
right? And I've heard them run myself,
you know,
too.
I mean, you know, the encounter I had with that female, you know, she didn't. Don't get me wrong. I didn't see her in a full on sprint for hundreds of yards. But when she took off, I got, you know, I saw her run for about 40 yards before she went back into the thicket. You know, and
yeah,
it's amazing. You know, you've never seen such a thing. You know. They're amazing creatures, and the thing is, they would not have such a developed buttocks leg area. You know, what is that? That's for performance on your feet.
Absolutely. You know? Well, and look at the environment they live in. For the most part, is very hilly and mountainous.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely, they wouldn't have that if they didn't need it. And that's all there is to it. You know, and.
Absolutely.
That's all there is to it, you know. And I can tell you, this guy, you know, from what I know about him, he's a, you know, just a tough, rugged dude, outdoorsman, and you know, he just said it was very humbling. You know, it scared the, you know, these guys. You're talking about four, you know, you're talking about two Air Force security police officers, very highly trained individuals, you know, armed to the teeth, who did not want to get out of their, this vehicle and. You know, do what they're supposed to do, you know, and, you know, this guy, you know, I've done a lot of interviews and, you know, you guys know as well as I do, we know enough about these creatures and, you know, you can tell when someone's lying to you. This guy was straight up. There's no way he was lying to me, you know, there's no.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, you know, when you've especially combining your own experience, and that's one thing about this organization, the Jumping Research Group, I wanted to bring in as many people as I could who had their own experiences for a couple of reasons. Of course, one, you know, when you listen to somebody's account, you can tell usually a little quicker. Now, sometimes, and I want to caution people that, you know, you can make mistakes. I've made mistakes.
Absolutely.
You know, with people that I, you know, got close to, you know, and gave them, you know, support for a supposed encounter, and then later on learned that their encounter was false, was concocted.
Yes.
So, you know, when you have a story, if you can check any of the details,
mm-hmm.
you know, you always want to do that, of course, mm-hmm. you know, to verify. Not that they're lying to you, but you don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to be able to take everyone on their word.
Sure.
But in today's world, it's just a place that we can't do that all the time.
No,
so.
You know, I always have little things that, you know, my particular little things I always listen for. You know, it's things that if they mention it, I can say, oh, you know what? They're probably telling me the truth. You know, or things that I'll ask them. And if they give me the wrong answer, you know, I can say, well, I think pretty good chance they're giving me a big BS story. You know, I don't tell people this stuff. You know, I keep it to myself. As test questions, you know.
You know, here's a topic. You know, I was thinking earlier today when Dustin actually brought up the idea of the roundtable.
Yeah.
You know, I've got the Bigfoot Fieldwork 101 books, and it's something we probably should talk a little bit about because there's a lot of people, especially today, that have gotten involved in the subject of Bigfoot. And they go out and they look around and they post stuff on Facebook, And if you take a look at all this stuff, it's kind of the same thing over and over and over again. They make claims, but they're short on information. Yes. And just from the sheer fact that I've been involved in this subject for so many years and learned this stuff by trial and error. And the trial and error is, if you make a claim, you better have something to back it up. Otherwise, people are going to say, well, you're full of crap.
Absolutely.
You know, and if you can provide supporting information, people will listen to you.
Absolutely.
So there's a real process to field work. And, you know, the first thing is, you can just go out and look any old place for Bigfoot. Maybe you'll find something, maybe you won't. Most chances are, most often you won't.
All right.
So, you know, of course, the first thing when I put the series together, and I'm still not finished with it, I have the last two to complete yet, but the first thing is having a little bit of equipment.
Sure.
You don't need a ton of equipment, but I would say a camera, certainly, some kind of a camera.
Absolutely.
And a way to record sound.
Yes, that's very important.
Maybe have a little bit of navigational tools so you can kind of navigate around the forest without getting lost.
Especially if you're in a very remote area. I know when
if
you have a GPS, I always carry one when I'm deep into the
Adirondack Park. If you're just a casual person thinking, hey, I might want to get involved in looking for Bigfoot, I would say don't go out and spend a ton of money. You know, at least have your phone with you, where you take pictures and maybe record. And thankfully, phones will do all that stuff nowadays. You know, when I was first doing this, you had to carry along, you know, a little trailer with all your stuff just so you'd have everything with you, you know. Just in film, you know, Renee DeHinden used to tell me to carry at least two cameras. And, you know, he'd say, well, you should have one camera loaded up with slide film and the other camera have black and white and color film. And you had to have particular kinds of film. So, you know, I'm walking around with all this stuff strapped on me. I look like a mercenary, you know, heading out into the woods, you know, with 65 pounds of gear strapped all over me and not being able to go too far through the brush because I've got too big of a footprint to get through the trees, you know. But just something as simple, you know, maybe a little notebook stick in your pocket.
Yep.
You know, if you're out hiking and you happen to see something, you know, you record the who, what, when, where,
yes.
and how.
Yep.
If you can record that about a situation, then you've got your bases pretty well covered. And if you go beyond that, of course, then there's interviewing people. That's a little trickier. Some people are good at it, some people aren't good at it. But you have to use that kind of a basis, and you can break that down. You know, when you go to interview somebody, let's just say, for instance, the who part, okay? Not just who was involved in the encounter. Who did they contact? Did they contact family members? Did they contact friends? Did they contact authorities? Were there other people in the adjacent area that may have seen something also?
Right.
Is there a history of people seeing things in that particular location?
Right.
You know, when you take, let's say, just the who part of that, you know, you want to run it out and exhaust it. Get as much information about all the people and everything about that particular place and the encounter. Go beyond the encounter. And then you go, of course, to what. Same thing. You know, of course, not just what happened, what was found. And again, you play that out. And the same thing with each one of those particulars. I mean, I don't know. What do you guys... I mean, I see the wheels turning. What are you guys thinking about that?
I can see
that.
Dustin's wheels spinning over there.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dustin. What are you thinking, man?
Well, I was going to go back on the what equipment to bring. Me and my...
Right.
One of my guys bought a... I forgot how much he said he paid for it, but it's a parabolic gear.
Okay.
It's not very big, and I don't know if y'all have used one or how y'all feel about them, but it's a super cool little toy because you can plug your headphones into it and you go hike a trail for about a mile in the dark and you can sit there and be quiet for about 5 minutes, put your headphones in and you can click it on and you can hear stuff I mean, you could hear a mouse fart from 50 yards.
That's it.
The only thing that's a great tool. The one thing I would suggest maybe that's a little better than that is an omnidirectional mic.
Okay.
And the reason why, if you've got that hooked up with a recorder, the parabolic dish is going to be focused in one direction. Yep. And let's say you get a scream coming from behind you. You know what I mean? You're not going to get a very good recording because you got the dish pointing the other direction. Right. But if you've got an omnidirectional mic, and I'll tell you, I was in a situation up in the Olympic Mountains a number of years back where, you know, we cooked our dinner in camp, decided to take a little walk up the road along the river at dusk, and I had my recorder in my shirt pocket, you know, sure that I was going to get a recording of a Sasquatch up there. And I'll be doggone if one didn't scream loud as hell on the ridge right above us. Everybody in the surrounding camps were, you heard all this, oh my God, what was that? Dogs going crazy and everything, but it only screamed once. Yep. So had I had an omnidirectional mic and actually hadn't had it turned on, I had an old little cassette, micro cassette recorder. So, you know, I had it out in a second ready to push the button. Or I did push the button, actually, but we never got any more vocals. But if you don't have the right equipment, you can actually miss out. But a parabolic mic is a good tool. If you're up in a place and you hear screams coming from a location, you can point that thing in that direction and get some much better recordings than what's available today.
Yeah, it was actually it was the first time I'd used it, and we were up on this mountainside. We'd been standing there quiet in the dark for about 10 minutes, and I clicked it on, and when you weren't using it, you couldn't hear. I think it had to have been a bobcat or something light on its feet, but it was, sure. It was angling up towards us. And, the double ear head, I let my buddy's 15-year-old son listen to it with me. And I kept it on the noise, and the whole time the hairs on the back of my neck started.
Oh, yeah. And
right.
Breathing real heavy, and like he was getting scared. And a couple of the guys, that was their first time out. And all I could do was turn around, and I was like, whatever y'all do, no matter what out, do not run for the love of God, whatever it is.
Yeah. That's right. That's good advice.
Right. I mean,
And here's another item also. If you want to, as you progress in getting involved in this, and the sound, what you want to do is not just go out and be doing guesswork, you know, like some of these TV shows and things do, and a lot of people do. They go out and they hear noises, and by God, that was Bigfoot.
Right.
Well, okay, what you want to do is remove doubt, and there's a couple of things that can help you do that. One is the amplified audio capabilities, like you talked about. The other one is you can go buy a cheap night vision sight for $100-$125.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not great, but in a dark situation, if you think something is close by, it can help you remove the doubt. I mean, I use a 10 million candle power spotlight. That pretty much burns off any of the tree leaves and everything close by. So I can see what's around me. I'm gonna have the Sasquatch smoldering if they get too close. But the night sight is great too. I mean, if you don't want to do that, if you want to just kind of be quiet and see what there is, you know, you turn that thing on and you look around, and like I said, they're not great quality. It helps you remove any doubts. If you do see something, you see, then it leads you to the next step. If you think you need to do a search of the area because there is something there, you think there's something there, you know, that's when you light up the forest and you do a search and see what's there, if you want to go that route.
Well, I actually had a night vision scope, but the guy that was supposed to bring it had left it in the truck, and we were about 10 minutes into the walk, and we decided that we weren't going to turn back. And
you were going to brave it.
Hearing, it was just outside of our flashlight power. And the terrain where we were at was a little too rugged for us to get off the trail. So we didn't.
Right.
Because where it was coming from was just a drop off, just about. It was a steep slant. So we were like, It's probably just a bobcat.
Yeah.
So equipment is always, it's all about kind of thinking what possibilities, what you might need.
Yeah.
And removing doubt in those situations. So going beyond the equipment, and then of course you start interviewing people, finding people who, and you can go look up old newspaper stories or magazine articles or whatever, maybe see if those people are still in the area, get a toehold in the area you're working. With witnesses, when I went to Vancouver back in the mid-80s, I put flyers around and I was contacted by one of the local newspaper editors. And after the interview, he said, well, you know, if you're really interested in getting involved in Skamania County, my photographer for the newspaper grew up here. He can take you out and show you around and where people are that actually have seen these things. And that's what he did. He took me out. And it gave me a toehold in that area. And then I spread out through all Southwest Washington in the following years after that. But that gave me a start, gave me a place to go and start looking. And actually, that led to my second sighting of one of these creatures. Because it was in a place where there was a lot of regular activity. So sometimes just one person can help you that's local,
right,
get established there. So the reports help you build a profile of the
area.
That's
right.
You need to know what's going on, when, and where. And that helps you kind of save your time, because believe me, you know, forested areas are pretty doggone big, and
sure,
you can spend thousands of hours and years out there looking in the wrong
places.
Absolutely.
You know. Oh, sorry. No, I was just going to say, I have a similar situation. That one of the areas that I'm working now, one of the state parks, I won't mention which one, you know which one I'm talking about, Will, where I had my second sighting. How I got to that is very similar to your situation. I met this guy who, he lays carpet for a living in that area, okay? And we got talking one day, and I threw the topic out there, just out in the wind.
Sometimes that's the way you got to do it.
Yeah,
just throw it out there.
Lo and behold, I was saying he lays carpet in that particular area. And he started telling me about all these encounters people had been telling him about. These very elderly people talking about encounters their fathers had all the way back to the 20s. So that led me to start investigating this particular state park. And I knew where to go, certain spots within the park, because it's a 70,000-acre state park, like you said. So you can't just go walking into these areas blind.
You can, but it's not going to be very fruitful
exactly,
most of the time.
But like I said, he told me, I found out where the areas of these sightings, I went, investigated, and I had a sighting of my own. You're absolutely right.
There's a lot of things beyond that. And then when you start getting beyond that, you want to really start keeping good records of what you're doing, where things are going on, have plenty of maps. You should learn a little bit about map reading. I mean, GPS is great, but the map helps you document things. And you can learn patterns by what you have
That's
on your
important.
Map. So, and then of course, simple things like casting tracks. I wrote one of the volumes is on just casting tracks, and believe me, having known the original pioneers of the subject in that aspect was absolutely no help, because they never told me how to cast tracks.
Yeah.
So I went out and found a really great set of 17-inch prints one time in Skamania County, poured the plaster in a couple of them, and they broke all the hell. So I lost the best tracks and the cast.
What do you hear? What do you guys hear on that new stuff for casting? It's like a plastic of some sort. Have you you might the PP229 or something?
I probably know what it is. I can't think of it.
You might have talked about it one night, I believe.
Yeah, probably. I know. I friends of mine have told me I should use dental.
See, I heard that too.
And I haven't had a chance really to experiment with it yet, but I'm going to do it hopefully this coming summer.
Yeah, I heard that too. You heard that, Dustin?
Yeah, I've heard the dental plaster.
Yeah.
The actual name for it, but I'm getting hold of a bucket.
It used to be fairly cost prohibitive, but I think it's come down quite a lot over the years. So, but you know, I mean, I can go over that real quickly. I mean, it was, since we're talking about these different procedures, you know, plaster isn't just something you go out and just pour into a hole in the dirt and pull it out and there it is. there's a little bit of a process to it, and it actually is kind of messy. I mean, what I usually do is I'll go to Lowe's or Home Depot, and you get, I think it's a 4.5 pound box. Not too expensive, and I'll tell you, for a Sasquatch track, it takes a whole one of those boxes for one footprint. So when I go to the field, I carry 100 pounds of plaster with me. That way I'm going to get about 20 tracks worth. You know, if I cast a lot of animal tracks, a lot of deer tracks, and all kinds of animals. So, then you got to carry water or have a water source, excuse me, close by.
You all right, bud? Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay, I got a cough, so I tried muting the mic, and it worked, and then it didn't work, so it's a Yeti microphone, so it's calling.
Yeah, that damn Yeti.
So you want to mix the plaster, and you want to try to do it. I do it by hand. Of course, that means you got to take latex gloves. I mean, you can do it with your bare hands, but you got to wash your hands pretty thoroughly afterwards. So, I mean, you got to think about the logistics behind it. I mix it by hand. You want to make it about the consistency of pancake batter. You pour it in, and it takes about 2 hours for it to dry enough to pull it out. And you can't just pull it out. You want to take a knife, and you dig around the impression and pull dirt and all out. And it takes, and if you're smart, you take about a couple of weeks, and you brush a little bit off and pick it off a little bit each day until you get a nice clean cast. Otherwise, you can really ruin it. I mean, when they were getting cast in Northern California here back in the 60s, they had it really easy because that was like flour, the dirt up there. You know, so they could pour the plaster and let it dry because it's hot up there, you know, and then they could just lift it out, brush it off, and here you got this great cast. In most places, it's not that simple.
Yeah.
So, but I have that. I've actually put it on other places. So I mean, if people want to know about that, they get in touch with me or get the volume, you know, that's all about that. It shows the equipment and how to do it step by step. So casting, and then knowing, you have to know a little bit about the wildlife in
that's
in your
extremely
area.
Important,
because you have to know what other animal sign is. Otherwise, you know, you don't want to look foolish.
Right.
You want to say anything you see, oh, that's Bigfoot. Well, you know, sorry, that was a raccoon or coyote or, you know, deer or something.
I mean,
you know,
foxes, you know, I've heard them make some noises. They'll curdle your blood, you know, a fox will curdle your blood, bobcats, you know.
Yeah, so getting some familiarity with the wildlife in an area is a real must. And then being able to identify that, and it kind of, I mean, it's a real progression.
It is.
Getting into this, if you want to, and then if you do find something, okay, you collect evidence, but there should be more evidence.
Yes.
I can't count how many times I see on Facebook, and I'm picking on Facebook, because people have put all these stuff structures up there. Well, how do you know a Sasquatch did that?
Yeah.
You see, they go out, they find something they think a Sasquatch did, they take a few pictures, post it on Facebook. Okay, look, folks, if you find something, you got to search.
Absolutely.
And there's plenty of information. I put in one of the volumes how to search. You can go online and find all kinds of methods, you know, spiral searches or grid searches. You need to search the area. I've talked to people who claim that they were, you know, Bigfoot experts. You know, people that I brought into the subject that I knew weren't experts.
There's no experts. Yeah.
In fact, I'll give you an example. There's one particular guy. This was back in the 90s. I was in the field unavailable. So Rene DeHinden called this guy and sent him on a recent encounter. It happened just a couple of days before he made the call, and there was a line of tracks. The guy and his wife go up, they cast about a dozen of the tracks, and went home. Guy gets himself on the Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and he thinks he's an expert. When I eventually found out about it, I went to his house and talked to him, looked at the cast, and I said, did you follow the line? Nope. Did you follow it where they came from? Nope. What? Did you? You didn't count the tracks. You didn't measure them. You didn't do anything. Well, I mean, come on now. That's just ridiculous. When DeHinden and Green and those guys talked to me about, you know, they were telling me about all the things they did, and one of the reasons they became famous in this was because they were very meticulous about those kinds of things. You know, they would find, when they were called down to Northern California on a track find, it was oftentimes thousands of tracks, and they would count them, every one that they could find, until they'd lose the trail. That adds legitimacy, you know, to a find. And if you're smart, you'll get somebody that knows something about tracking, and you can develop a behavioral profile based on that line of tracks. Of course, if there's no behavioral profile, then they're fake.
Absolutely. A track is a sign. A track is a mark of a living, breathing creature. You know.
Right, and you can tell what they're doing by how the tracks are laid into the soil.
Mm-hmm. Whether they're, you know, running, walking, you know, following a line of prey, their prey tracks, you know, absolutely.
Sure. Are they moving through the area stealthily, or are they just wandering through? It tells you what they're doing. Now, if they're hunting in an area, that can tell you that they might be in that area for a longer duration. If they're just passing through the area, then there isn't a whole lot of reason to focus and spend a lot of time there. But if they're doing something specific in that area, that could give you reason to want to stay there longer and really focus on that area. I mean, it's all about utilizing your time and resources. That's right. Because I know some people think they're going to live forever, but let me tell you, you know, it runs out quickly. You know, time goes by fast.
It sure does. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you've really got to follow through with your evidence. You know, I've heard individuals, and you know, you guys have too. And not too long ago, you know, an individual that we were very familiar with that's not involved in the group anymore. Actually, I remember him saying, you know, I'm tired of seeing tracks. They do nothing. You know, they do nothing for us. And I, you know, I responded. I'm like, you know, you got a lot of audacity saying that, you know, because even though you may think they're not doing anything, that, you know, maybe they didn't lead or give you any further information last time, but this, you know, these few tracks you're seeing this time around could tell you a whole nother story than they did last time.
Especially if you're building up a database on what's going on in a particular location, and we'll use, let's say, the Bluff Creek area, for instance. And I won't pick on them too bad for that decade because it was brand new, and nobody really knew. Even if these things were real, they were, when something was found, they would go there, you know, document it, but they didn't really develop the information. And like, typically a lot of people, you know, when they think about Bluff Creek, they think, oh, these things were just there all the time. Well, they weren't. About every 3 to 4 years is when the Sasquatches would appear in that area, and they weren't going there directly. They were actually, that was sort of a peripheral area they would come through. They were actually going from the northwest to the southwest in that area. So, you know, and again, that's over time, you know, when you go back and look at the information, and of course, having known the people who were there, I remember that.
Yeah.
So if you knew that, you wouldn't focus on that place. You would focus on where the heavier traffic was, would have been to the west of there. And again, it goes back to that, you know, you gotta really think about your resources, time, equipment, you know, your everything that you're putting right into it.
Now, Dustin, and both of you actually, now, that incident that took place in your neck of the woods, you know, the big one, you know, in Oklahoma, I'm talking about, you know, do you know what I'm speaking of, Will? Yes. Now, was there, as far as what we're talking about right now, you know, I know there was supposedly a lot of stuff that happened there on that land. Now, as far as forensic evidence, was there any ever taken as far as, you know, tracks, you know, was there any ever tracks casted or anything, or?
Well, I don't know about casting, but Mike did send me some pictures.
Yeah, I heard pictures, but that was about it from what I've heard.
Right. Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah, he's Mike's a good guy. He doesn't talk a lot. You know, and I don't know if that's due to, I mean, because they had a bad experience with the BFRO with that whole incident, and and I'm sure there are other things that have caused this guy's friction, but you know, of course, that's why we're grateful to have Dustin and our team there, because you know we want the opportunity to have an independent look at what's going on in that region. So,
and I'm
Dustin, you're in the hot seat, man.
That's right, job. That's right.
I'm trying to get permission to go research any property as close as I can to where, you know, I told you where I think the house was. It's a little bit tough because a lot of people out there, you know, they either don't talk about this or don't want outsiders coming on their property.
Sure.
There is a couple of people leasing their land to hunt, but they're wanting god-awful amounts of money, which, I mean, you know, I'm a hunter, so therefore I could use it for both, but...
Sure.
Let me ask you a question. Now, you've done a little bit of talking to folks around there. Do you think them being quiet is any... Do you think there's any resulting behavior on their part due to the way that the BFRO and kind of the bad taste that left in some of the locals' mouths?
See, I haven't heard about what happened with the BFRO out there, but that town is a very small populace, and just think that, I don't know, they're really small-time people, and I just think that if they think outsiders are trying to come in, and period, I don't think it has very much to do with the BFRO, I just think it's them
closed mouth about it, you know, and I deal with that stuff up here in those small areas in the Adirondack Park, you know, like our old friend Woody. You know, I was fortunate to have him because those people up there in that area would not speak to me.
And it might be just finding the right
and
person.
You know, like I've said, Will, you and I have talked about this many times. In these areas where these things are out, these people that live up there in the sticks like that, they know. You know, they know.
Oh, sure they do. Yeah, locals,
they don't talk
locals,
about it,
though.
You know, and that's just how it is. They aren't going to talk to outsiders, you know. You know, I'm lucky around here to, you know, I have the reservation, you know. I'm lucky to have ins with them. You know, they talk to me, but they won't talk to outsiders about it, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
These people know, and that's all there is to it. So, Dustin, I agree with you on that. I think it might be more just that they just don't want to speak to outsiders about it, you know.
It's that, and also down in that area, there's also kind of a drug traffic kind of down in there, lot of meth, and there's been a lot
of... You know, I hear that in a lot of places, you know, these wilderness areas. I know, I'll give you an example. Even up towards Bluff Creek and that
region, marijuana.
Everybody says it's the pot growers
up here.
But on the other side of that coin, you know, I've been all over that country, never saw anybody up there. So, I mean, maybe I'm just lucky I didn't go to the right or the wrong places, you know, or it's exaggerated.
Yeah. You know, A little bit of both, I'm sure. You know.
Yeah.
Out in a way.
Wait, what's that, Dustin? You were cut off.
I said it should be exaggerated in order to keep people from coming in.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, because I know about it up there. You just said it. Jeremiah, you've said it. I've heard it from other people about different areas, and I'm thinking, okay, I want to know what the truth of that is. And I'll give you another example. I worked for a few years for a company just outside of Fort Lewis, and it was on the other on the backside where it's, you know, fairly sparse, the population. Now, I know from having been stationed at Fort Lewis, the training area is back on that side of the boundary. And then also from friends who lived in the little communities around there. And the company I worked for, we used to have our regular safety meetings, and they talk about being careful because of all the meth labs and things right on base there. But we did a lot of extensive training in those training areas, and I never saw anything out there. Yeah. No people. So again, it's sort of like, okay, what are you left to believe in situations like that? I mean, that's an important point if you're going to go big shit hunting. Yeah,
you believe in situations sometimes.
You know, be careful because, you know, it could be true. Maybe it's not true. The thing is, you don't know, but you got to be on guard.
You got to worry about a big hairy beast getting after you. Also got to
absolutely.
Yeah, I know. I know it's like you're kind of throwing your backside to the four winds, right. You know, going looking for Bigfoot because you got Mr. Sasquatch that wants to turn you into a Happy Meal, and then on the other hand you got Billy Bob down the road that's out making his meth or whatever. So, you know, here are your choices. Which one do you choose? It's not a win-win situation. No,
it's really not. It's really not a win-win.
I guess the thing that would make it worse is if the Sasquatch was making the meth. You know, TW is here.
Oh, it'd be all rolling, over. So. And you know me with TW. I lose all my bearings. Just totally lose all my bearings. It's just unbelievable. Oh,
but that's one of the volumes I have yet to write is about safety. Yeah. and safety is a big concern. I mean, from other people out there, that's an obvious one. And I think in this day and age, it seems to be getting worse. There's some real crazy people out there. But and now that's a consideration for the Sasquatch too. And it kind of goes back to those abilities we talked about in the beginning of the show. You're talking about something that's very likely an apex predator, or certainly very high on in the pecking order. It's not some fuzzy, warm, you know, from the movie Harry and the Hendersons, where you're going to walk up and pet him. You know, sorry, he's gonna wipe his backside with you instead of
silly you know. Idea.
But it's like a grizzly. You're not just gonna walk up to it and say, "Oh, that's." Yeah, I mean, you have to respect wild animals, especially predatory.
That's when I go and I do my research. I always carry a firearm. I treat them as I would. I'm wary of them as I would be. You know, we've got a lot of cats, big cats, back in the Adirondacks now. You know, I always treat them as I would a cat or a bear. You know, I by no means am I saying these things are out to you know. Do a genocide on the human race by any means, you know, but you treat them, be weird. You treat them as a bear or, you know, a cat or whatever. They are an apex predator. You know, treat them as such.
And I'm going to refer also to last week's show where our anthropologist, John, we talked about, and one of the things he said right in the beginning of the show was about how aggressive primates are in general across the board.
Chimpanzees.
You know, when people think that monkeys and apes are clowns and all this stuff, I'll tell you what, chimps have to be trained to be like that. In the wild, they're not
savage.
Like that at all.
Very savage.
Yeah, they're very savage, and all primates are. So these things are not going to be
absolutely
different.
Not.
So Yeah, so if you don't have a very healthy respect for something like that, you're setting yourself up.
You know, and I was thinking of something, Will. You know, I have, in my opinion, you know, when we've talked about the weight, okay, of these big males, you know, I think I've always maybe estimated them at about 1,000 pounds. Well, you know, I've got thinking about something. That guy that held the record for the world's tallest man for a long time, Robert Wadlow, remember? He was like eight foot eight or something like that. And at his peak, mm-hmm. when he was 8 foot eight, he weighed 550 pounds. Okay. Now, if you picture a Sasquatch next to him at 8 foot eight, the body mass blows him away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, so yeah, I'm thinking more than 1,000 pounds for a big male.
Right. I'll tell you what, the second sighting I had, that thing was, it was at least 9 feet high, probably 10. Had 18-inch tracks, and I estimated at the time somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds. And sometimes I think that was almost a conservative estimate.
You know, that last one I saw, I would say 1,500 pounds, you know. And I was telling you, you know, when I had that encounter with that juvenile, you know, he was no more than 4.5 by 5 feet tall, and he was still pushing 200 pounds. You know, and that's big, you know.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the young ones are much heavier.
Not much heavier, and that, even in that tiny one, he could have torn me right apart.
And I know the question that comes to my mind now, and I know people are thinking this, well, if they're so heavy, how come we don't find tracks all over the place?
It takes a lot. Sometimes the ground's not conducive for it, first of all.
Right, well, tracks do get found a lot, much more than people who aren't interested in the subject or aren't involved in it. No. Secondly, when I read Diane Fossey's book, Gorillas in the Mist, back in the 80s, one of the things that really struck me was the fact that when they would go out and look for these groups of gorillas. Now, gorillas, their ranges are about 12 kilometers for a group. And they talked in the book about this has been a long time ago since I read this, so I'm trying to remember as best I can. They talked about looking for a particular group that had about 20 members. Yeah. Now, you're talking about an animal that can get up to 500-600 pounds.
Yes.
Now, when there's a group of 20 of them moving, you would think they'd be like a herd of elephants, you know, leaving a big swath, you know, as they move. Not the case.
Right.
They had professional trackers who were very, very experienced, you know, locals in that area, that part of Africa. And it was oftentimes almost impossible for them to track whole groups of gorillas. So for a single or even a small group of these creatures in very rocky ground, hard ground, mountainous areas where people aren't, you're not going to find prints as often.
No, I mean, in 2007, before they discovered the Billy Ape, I think it took two years to track that particular group.
It was quite a while, yeah.
You know, that's crazy. It's amazing. You know.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something also. You know, with the Sasquatch, they're not just going to be wandering around where people are and say, "Hey, look, come find me. I've left tracks all over the place." If they're coming close to where people are, it's because they're after some kind of goodies or after food of some kind. You know, and they're going to be stealthy the way they move. It's not necessarily that they're hiding footprints, but they're going to move in places where they're not seen and such.
That's interesting.
So,
you say that.
They're not it's not going
to
be
obvious.
That's right.
I was talking to Don a couple weeks ago. I'm sure he told you this too, but for you, Dustin, Don was saying that he went up, you know, where he had that sighting, and he noticed, you know, he found a track, okay? But the way this thing, there was a set of trees, a line of trees, and under the trees, there was big moss beds, okay? And he noticed the moss beds, there were some really big indentations, but he said he couldn't make it out that they were tracks. So he was thinking, and I got thinking about it, was that thing running in the moss on purpose? You know what I mean?
I've seen him move on moss.
Yeah, you think that on purpose, maybe to hide the tracks more?
Well, you know, like all primates, they're going to be extremely intelligent. So
We don't know. It's possible.
Sure. Yeah, it's within the realm of possibility.
It might not have been the not lead tracks. I might have just knew that going across the moss would be a lot stealthier than, you know, moving.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Quieter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Well, fellas, we're about out of time. We'll do this again real soon. I like to do these roundtables a couple times a month. So, thanks for coming on this evening. Everybody, again, go to my website, williamjevning.com. There's some interesting stuff there. Join the website. Join one of the teams if you're interested. We're looking for people that are not just going to the field, but all sorts of activities or things you might be willing to help out with. I mean, literally anything. So get in touch with one of the guys on the web pages there. And, you know, with the holidays coming, take a look at the shop. There's lots of fun things there for your Bigfoot enthusiasts. So, fellas, thanks again. And I'm kind of thinking maybe I will, Dustin, I'll put your interview, I'll put two shows up this week. I'll put yours as a second one, folks. So it's only about 40 minutes long. So I'll put two up since it's Thanksgiving. We'll put two up this week. And, fellas, we'll do this again real soon. Thanks for joining us.
See you, Dustin. Have a good night, buddy.